From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Temescal.
Tenderloin.
Treasure Island.
Richmond, California.
Coming up, we're navigating the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta with a farm family that's worked the land for generations.
We ship corn and wheat, you know, various grains out of here in our trucking business. We also ship pears, our main crop, and wine grapes, and olives. Did I miss any?
Then we'll revisit the construction of the first Bay Bridge nearly 80 years ago. At the time, it was called
the largest, longest, and greatest completed highway bridge in the world.
And a father and son talk about their battle with mental illness.
It's not a tragic story. It's an epic story. It's just a crazy thing that happened to me, and it's going to be part of my past.
Those stories are coming up next on Cross Currents. The California Delta. It's just east of the Bay Area between Sacramento and Stockton. We've been exploring it in an ongoing series called Navigating the Delta. Major California rivers drain there, and over decades, it's become the major hub of the state's water system. The land used to be made up of tidal wetlands and marshes, but today there are nearly 60 islands surrounded by levees. Most of the land is used for farming, and it's some of the richest farmland in the state. Reporter Lisa Morehouse takes us to meet two people whose families have deep roots in the Delta agriculture.
I'm driving down a long road on Andrus Island in the Central Delta, headed for Kay Dix Farm. It's home to pear orchards, a packing shed, a business office, and some truck storage. The man in charge here is Daniel Wilson, whose family's farmed the Delta for generations. Wilson lives just down the road in a house built by his grandfather almost 100 years ago.
Now, we're going to take you into an orchard, and we're going to show you kind of different stages of growth.
We walk past the packing facility. It's quiet now, but in summer it buzzes with machines and people, washing, treating, and separating pears by size, wrapping them in tissue so the delicate fruit can withstand being shipped across the country. They grow several thousand tons of pears each year.
These are Bartlett pears. This was the entire river 30 years ago. Every single tree was this 30 years ago.
The winter orchard is filled with Medusa-like pear trees.
We've now diversified away from these trees, and we've gotten other varieties.
Using an age-old practice, they've grafted a pear called Stark Crimson onto stumps of old Bartlett trees because, Wilson says, new varietals can bring in almost twice as much as Bartlett pears right now.
One could argue we've diversified away from these so much that we're starting to go, oops, went too far. But that's farming. You change varieties, you try to see what's profitable.
Pears were one of the first commercial crops in the Delta.
I have trees next to my house. You can see those trees in the distance that are 130, 140 years old. Grandpa plants five different types of fruit, and the pears are the one that lived.
Why have people grown pears and other crops here for so long?
It's nice soil, it's rich in nutrients, and, you know, it's close to population centers back in the day.
Back in the days of the gold rush. Many of the most successful people of the time weren't miners, but were instead the ones who sold food and supplies to the miners, says Wilson.
You wanted to be the guy selling the shovel, not the guy digging with the shovel.
While miners sought their fortunes in the hills, the state encouraged farmers to come to the Delta and basically turn part-time swampland into full-time farmland by building levees. That's how this area came to be what it is today.
So back in the 1850s, they passed the Arkansas Swamp and Reclamation Act, and they said, state, we'll give you this land here in these marshes in Arkansas and California if you give them to people and the people build levees around it and reclaim the land and turn it into productive farmland, then they can keep it. And that's when these reclamation districts are formed, and the local farmers built the levees and kept the water back, and that's how agriculture developed in the Delta.
Agricultural infrastructure looked pretty different back then. In the 1920s and 30s, when fruit growing really picked up, Wilson says farmers here would take pears across the island to the Sacramento River, which is about a mile away.
They would load the fruit onto a schooner, and the schooner would pick up at various farms, and then it would turn around and head back down to San Francisco.
Labor was different, too. Today, most of the crews Wilson hires to pick and pack pears are Latino.
When I was a kid, every pear crew that worked around here was from the Philippines.
Filipinos were essential to Delta agriculture and were most famously linked with the asparagus crop. I drive over to a former labor camp on nearby Twitchell Island with 93-year-old Nicholas Catano. He knows the history of Filipinos in the Delta firsthand.
This is practically all asparagus. All these fields right in here.
Catano's Portuguese mother met his Filipino father on a plantation in Hawaii, where Catano was born. When his paternal grandfather found better work in California, most of the family came here, including a one-year-old Nicholas. His family farmed and became labor contractors.
I supervise these fields here, yeah, as a labor contractor. Here's a packing shed right here. He still has the machinery in there.
After showing me the field, Catano directs me to his home, which sits atop a levee. It's stuffed with neatly hung, perfectly pressed clothes and fishing poles and old photographs.
I got a picture in there I want to show you if you had time to look at it, though.
One posed portrait shows well over 100 people, almost all young men. It was taken at a large gathering of Filipinos in Los Angeles.
These are all farmers and farm laborers in the Delta.
And they're dressed to the nines in fine suits. Most Filipinos in the Delta were men. In fact, the only women and children in the image belonged to Catano's family, due in large part to his father's position as a labor contractor.
We had a lot of men. You know, they all came from all over, you know, from the Philippines, from the Hawaiian Islands, you know, from wherever they were urged to come here.
Catano says his father organized crews of Filipino workers to move around the state, harvesting different crops. In the Delta, cutting asparagus, which they called grass, was back-breaking work.
And they would cut more or less about 4 acres each, 4 acres a day apiece, which was almost impossible to do. You had to have 2 or 3 knives all sharp all the time, you know, stone in your hand, always sharpening your knives.
And workers would place the hand-picked asparagus onto sleds pulled by horses. There's still some asparagus grown in the Delta, but for the last couple decades, cheaper asparagus, imported from Mexico, has made many farmers here turn to other crops that make a higher profit and require less labor. Now, many of the fields that grew asparagus hold corn, alfalfa, and other crops that need just a combine and one driver for 100 acres. Daniel Wilson's one of those farmers. He gave up growing asparagus years ago, but he runs part of his business in a building connected to the crop's history in the Delta.
This facility you see hanging out over the water started its life as a Southern Pacific Railroad packing shed, or produce, by the way, for asparagus in specific. They would pack the asparagus and the entire river would be covered with asparagus butts.
Now it's a grain elevator, one of his family's many business endeavors. Along with farming and grain storage, they're in the transportation business, too.
We ship corn and wheat, you know, various grains out of here in our trucking business. We also ship pears, our main crop, and wine grapes, and olives, and anything else we can think of. But those are our main products. Did I miss any? So those are our main things we haul out of the Delta.
It's all part of being a successful farming family, not depending solely on pears.
Any crop that you're totally devoted to makes you a little vulnerable to if the pears go bad, which they have in the late 40s and the 80s and times like that, then you want to diversify into other things.
Along with diversifying, farmers around the Delta are trying other strategies to stay viable. There's a huge farmers market at the intersection of two major highways, and it's filled with Delta wine and produce and stories about the farmers. Local businesses hand out tour maps for visitors to drive up the river and visit local farms along the way. Like Wilson, they want to keep farming here.
We have pretty deep roots here. We farm here because we can make good money, and we like the area. I'm sure if you talk to a farmer in Dinuba or one in Oroville, they'd tell you the same thing. The dad farmed here and grandpa farmed here, and so I'm farming here.
Wilson's children and nephews work for him, and he sees neighbors' kids still involved, especially on the business side of farming. He says there's not a lot of big ag here. Though he sees the number of owners getting smaller and their operations getting bigger, Wilson says there are few, if any, widely held corporations involved in farming in the Delta.
It's a complicated area to survive in. You have to take care of the levees. You have to take care of the drainage. We're regulated much more heavily than a lot of other areas.
Every farmer I talk to in the Delta has concerns about the state's proposed Bay Delta Conservation Plan, which would build tunnels at the north end of the Delta to ship water across the state. They have questions about how much farmland would be lost to tunnel construction and wetland restoration, and about the quality of the Delta water. Daniel Wilson shares these concerns, but in the meantime, he's sticking to what his family's done for over a century.
I love to farm. I like this area. I like to grow things. So if we can figure out how to make money doing something we love to do, then we've got our questions answered.
In the Delta, I'm Lisa Morehouse for Cross Currents.
Our series will continue next Wednesday when we'll see how water recreation has been changing the Delta.
Well, of course, you know, I live on the water and everybody that lives, so all my neighbors are on the water. You know, we're pretty much connected to the water. I'm here because of the river.
That's next week when we continue our series, Navigating the Delta. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. It's been a long, rough road on the way to building the new eastern span of the Bay Bridge. Now, 6 months after opening, it's become a more familiar part of the cityscape. Some people like me love the new design, but it's still sad to see the old bridge slowly disappearing. And some of the people who know the bridge best are really lamenting what we've lost.
I'm a blue-collar kind of person, and this is a blue-collar bridge. The other one is more like for Hollywood. I hate to say that, but that's the only way I can put it.
Richard Meradian of Manteca is a steel worker who's had many jobs on the bridge since he started in 1978. And with the old structure still standing next to the new, it's become a symbol of time passing. In this piece from our archives, KALW's Stephen Short takes us back in time to tell us the story behind the original Bay Bridge.
The first recorded suggestion of a bridge across the bay was by San Francisco's most beloved eccentric, Emperor Norton I, self-proclaimed Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. He issued this decree, which appeared in the Pacific Appeal newspaper on March 23, 1872.
The following is decreed and ordered to be carried into execution as soon as convenient. That a suspension bridge be built from Oakland Point to Goat Island, and then to Telegraph Hill, provided such bridge can be built without injury to the navigable waters of the Bay of San Francisco.
It would be more than 60 years before Emperor Norton's idea became reality. Design plans were led by State Highway Engineer Charles Purcell, with construction beginning July 8, 1933. The main contractor was the American Bridge Company of Pennsylvania, the same company that built the Empire State and Chrysler buildings in New York. Critics said it was an impossible task, but the project was a welcome endeavor. A worker in the 1930s, in the Great Depression, was grateful for any kind of steady employment.
I don't think there was the animosity today about government programs.
Greg Bayall is a retired public information officer for the Bay Bridge. He held that position from the mid-1980s until 2004.
Name a program and somebody's there immediately to put it down. Yeah. And I think at that time it was kind of accepted that, you know, this is what government did for you. You know, they built things so that make your life better.
Building the bridge was extremely difficult work, and it was dangerous, even deadly. At least 28 workers died during construction.
A lot of people lost their lives on that bridge. It was unbelievable.
Evelyn Rhodes of Livermore, interviewed in 2012 at the age of 97, remembers when her father worked on the bridge.
There's no safety nets or nothing. People have no idea how bad things could get years ago, you know, because there's nothing to protect you. If you were working class, you were doomed. They figure you're either going to get killed or you're going to die falling off of something.
Work was continuous then, too, all day and all night. There were safety measures, but not as stringent as today.
American Bridge built the suspension span, and they required their people to wear a leather safety hat.
Chuck Syme, a retired maintenance engineer, didn't help build the bridge, but remembers talking with people who did.
And if you look at pictures, you'll see people with leather safety hats and bareheaded people. because there was no enforcement.
Photos depict workers walking above the bay on unsecured wooden planks. Remember, the roadbed is about 190 feet above the water. And you can add another 300 feet or so to the top of the towers on the west span. Those leather safety hats that Syme mentions looked like football helmets of that era and would not have provided much protection. And for the record, current-style hard hats were also available. But there was another danger beyond the lack of safety enforcement.
See, there was this machoism. You know what I mean. Yeah, if you showed any kind of fright, boy, they'll drum you off the bridge.
This macho man attitude even extended to Governor Frank Merriam. While cutting the chains to open the bridge on November 12, 1936, he refused to put on safety glasses.
Governor Merriam is taking the assessment torch in his hand, having put on some gloves. He won't put on the glasses, evidently. There's a bit of delay, although for safety's sake, the glasses should be put on.
Safety glasses or no, the impossible task was finished, and half a year ahead of schedule at that. More than 8,000 men worked to build that bridge. Total cost, $77 million. That's equivalent to nearly $1.4 billion in today's dollars, or about one-fifth of what it's costing for the new project. Again, former Public Information Officer Greg Bayall.
It was incredible. There was nothing that came near it. And you could say, I mean, when I answered the phone at my job, and people have a question about the bridge, you could tell them, it's the longest bridge in the world.
Several bridges surpass that record today, even if you include both the east and west spans of the Bay Bridge. But its significance for that time remains untarnished. In 1955, the American Society of Civil Engineers selected the Bay Bridge as one of the 7 modern civil engineering wonders of the United States. For Cross Currents, I'm Stephen Short.
You can learn more about the past and present of the Bay Bridge at a new exhibit at the DeYoung Museum. The exhibit combines photographs and drawings of the bridge. For more information, go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for your stories from San Francisco StoryCorps, which is debuting its new location at the main library this week. Josh Lampert was 19 years old and away at college when he says his recreational drug use triggered a mental illness. It was called psychotic depression, and it involved intense hallucinations. He was forced to move back in with his parents, and together they spent the next few years struggling to manage his illness. Now in his early 30s, Josh considers himself fully recovered. He's healthy, independent, and working. Josh and his father, Chuck Lampert, visited the San Francisco StoryCorps booth in July of 2013 to talk about what happened.
In your words, what happened to me?
So you were 19 years old and living on your own in Seattle with your brother going to school, and your brother called us up and said something was wrong. You know, jumped on a plane, flew across the country, you know, and you met me at the airport. And it was real scary because you had lost a lot of weight and you were afraid. You were paranoid. Part of you knew that something was wrong, and then the other part took over, and I think you battled with yourself.
I felt like I was cramping your style a little bit. You guys were empty nesters, and I moved back in. I had nowhere else to go.
Yeah, but I think you'll learn when you have kids that love for your kids is unconditional. When you got sick, I tried to learn everything I could about circumstances like that. And the worst thing that happens is when people get abandoned by their families. We watched every minute of what you were doing. We were hyper-vigilant about every nuance. You didn't know how to help yourself, but I think you had enough insight. You saw your friends moving along in their lives, and you sort of got stuck in a certain spot.
That was the hardest part for me, was seeing other people seem like they had so much, and I was just struggling. And on top of it, when I would get angry, it made it worse, because people would get frustrated with me when I was angry, and that was the only natural reaction to what I had. So over the course of a couple of years of dealing with it, it's just like it wore me down, and sometimes it seemed like I can't do one more day of this, you know. And that's people's worst fear with a mental illness, I think, is someone will kill themselves. And I said, I'm not going to do that, so I really have only one other option, which is to overcome this. It took really getting on the right medication to have a, it was just like a moment of clarity. It was like I was in a storm, and then finally the clouds parted enough for me to see what was going on around me. And then I started rebuilding because I just saw wreckage.
I'm really thrilled the way your life is going. You've put back together so many of the pieces. I mean, you're taking care of yourself, and you're living a healthy lifestyle. You know, you race the bikes, and you work hard, and you know, I'm proud of you.
People say there's no recovery with mental illness. I say that's not true, because I'm fine. I have no symptoms. I'm a success story, and it can be done. This finished on a positive note. It's not a tragic story. It's an epic story. It's just a crazy thing that happened to me, and it's going to be part of my past.
That story was produced by KALW's Rachel Wong. You too can share your story by visiting the new StoryCorps location at the San Francisco Public Library Main Library starting February 21st. All of the details are at KALW.org. Just click on StoryCorps. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Jasmine Lopez, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Charlotte Silver, Raisu Sussman, Julia Scott, and Stephen Short. Today's show was produced by Leela Day and engineered by Seth Samuel. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And we are listener-supported radio, and for that, we thank you. The music you're hearing now is by Rom Bauer. He says his first name came to his mother in a dream shortly before he was born. Though he's classically trained as a lyric tenor, he now favors music inspired by American soul singers. Rom Bauer will be performing in his hometown of San Francisco on Friday at the Lost Church. Music starts at 8:15 sharp. That information, along with more local music and more local stories, is at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.